but he's very sort of granite chinned. That's the answer. Anyway, I saw a little quote that a recent thing when I was reading up on him, that where he said he was going to make a film this year that was like a Scottish commitment type thing, but a bit darker. And his mate was going to fund it, and he wanted some money released for something, locations, whatever it was. And they got into an argument, and in the end, he thought, "Fuck it, I'm not going to do the film, and I'm not going to do any films." And the reason was because he'd realised that the sort of clothing, for want of a better word, that he had to put on to get into that mindset of making stuff, he didn't like himself. He didn't like the fact that it was obviously, it was his mate and he was trying to steamroller him. And he thought, actually, I don't like being this person anymore.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm not going to do any films. And he's doing painting and art. And it's quite nice, actually. It's always, you know, when advertising people say they're going into art, always makes me wince. I think, oh, it's going to be terrible. But it's nice. Yeah.
I wrote to that I took that Helmut Krohn book again. Yeah, and I was reading that whenever it was a few years ago and thought, God, I wonder if we could find one of his pictures, you know, I mean,
his paintings.
Yeah, his paintings. I wonder if there's...
So yeah, are they on the market, any of his paintings?
Well, eventually.
I think there's some in the book. In that
there
book,
are, there, yeah,
which look
absolutely.
Quite nice.
And there's some that look a bit... And then there's some where you think, oh, and I just thought, you know, I've got a few old original VW ads, but it'd be great to have one of his. And if you're going to buy a painting, why not
absolutely,
have a story?
Yeah,
but, you know, I like...
Link,
So and so, I searched online everywhere. I couldn't find anything. And eventually, I wrote to
Clive Challis.
No, I didn't. There's a guy who's the sort of chairman emeritus of DDB, who set up Omnicom, and he was a creator.
Oh, I know that. It's Keith Reinhart.
Keith Reinhart.
He used to come in to DDB when I was there.
Yeah, and he's still there.
Is he?
So, yeah. And he does Cannes every year. I did a thing with him in Cannes a couple of years ago. He does the students. He just does talks. You know, and He made a lot of money, a lot of great work, put Omnicom together. You know, I mean, very interesting guy.
Is interesting to me now. He used to come in, he was like this, you've seen him, funny little goofy skinny guy in a suit that was too big for him.
Yeah.
And the vibe would be, oh, Keith Reinhart's coming in. He's giving out his silly pointy awards for the Pinnacle. I don't know if that's still going. Is that still going?
No.
And it was like, he was some, brilliant. It's like everybody thought he's a bit of a, I think of the polite, most polite word, but it was like, and then I've read up about him since, and he was the reason that they put Omnicom.
Yeah,
I think it was either his idea or he made it happen. Part of it because you probably know all this, but because they wanted him. DD, you know, all those companies wanted him.
Yeah,
when he was
Yeah,
but they wanted him.
Yeah,
because of what he and.
He did loads of very famous McDonald's work.
Yeah,
in a big populist kind of.
Yeah.
I can remember as a kid going to the States for the first time and seeing some of those ads, and then found out 200 years later he'd.
Yeah.
But I love it because it's, you know, that whole thing about, oh, keep creative people away from the money or the business or whatever. And of course, it's not, you know, I mean, it's nonsense. And he did it. And they've got a big new lineup in New York, and they've all discovered this guy sitting there, and they love him.
In DDB.
So they bring him out. But I wrote to him and said, you know, look.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, well, gosh, I mean, he gave us one once. We never hung it on the wall. It was terrible. Let me talk to my wife.
He said that.
Yeah. And then he basically wrote back and said, I've asked everyone. No one's got a clue. Everyone got given one and sort of heaved them in the skip eventually. They were all awful. And I thought, oh, Christ.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Let's go.
Are we good? Right, Dave.
Ben.
Thank you for coming. Can you come into your own blog? I think you probably can. Anyway, welcome.
You can.
Thank you for coming in. I should just set the scene is that you interviewed me a few weeks ago, and when I was leaving, I thought, actually, if I was doing this, one of the people that I'd want to interview would be Dave Dye, and I suspect that's obviously quite difficult for Dave Dye, and you might be too modest to even suggest it. So I emailed you can I come back?
Yep.
Can we swap seats, which we have? Yep. We're now sitting in different chairs at the microphone. And can I interview you for your own blog? So thank you for agreeing to it.
Well, thanks for asking.
And
I feel quite anxious in this, I've got to say, because I normally turn up prepared. And I turn up thinking, oh, I wonder how he did that and what this was. and I turn up now blank. I've no idea what humiliating questions you're going to ask or where it goes. So.
Well, you're definitely prepared because you've lived it. I'm gonna unashamedly crib from your technique, if I may.
Okay.
So, the first thing I wanted to know is just right back to the start. So, where were you born? Where are you from? Your kind of background.
Well, it's quite cool now. At the time, it wasn't cool at all. So my family was from Hoxton in London, which is all very cool and trendy now, but wasn't when I was born. And I was christened in Hoxton Square, which I didn't used to tell anyone, but now I try and weasel that into conversation. And I was brought up in Bethnal Green, again, when that was totally couldn't be less cool than it is now. It's bizarre to see how it's changed.
And what
East
your,
End
what,
kid.
And how did you get to the Arsenal then? Why are you not a West Ham? Should you not be a West Ham fan?
I don't know. I haven't measured that one out. I think it's pretty close to Arsenal, and I think it's probably got a lot to do with a cousin pushing me that way. And then when I was at that very impressionable age, Arsenal won the double.
Yeah. So, always helps.
Yeah. So it would have been Emmanuel. I've got a vague memory of liking Man United because of George Best.
Yeah.
And they were popular. But then when they won the double, obviously chased that little bit of success and switched me over.
Yeah. So, and your mum and dad, not connected to the business
Nothing
in any
way?
Nothing
to do with advertising in any way. Although I say that, and funnily enough, I remembered on the way down that there is a sort of incredibly tenuous connection, which is that my dad's a decorator, and he used to decorate for Charles Saatchi.
Really?
Yeah. And he would tell me about him. So he would say, because at the time, I think that would be in the 70s, and the things he would say I thought were interesting. I hadn't until recently sort of thought connected the two, but he would say whenever you go into his office, he is doing nothing. He's got nothing on his desk. He's not busy. He wanders around. And this would have been like 76 or 7. And then the other thing he said to my dad is, you've got to whip them and burn them. Which is very harsh. But yeah, so he'd have various stories about this guy, Charles Saatchi, and then he would work for Rodney Fitch, who was a design guy. So there was a sort of vague link, so I'd kind of hear about these people who sounded quite cool. That might have something to do with it, but I hadn't really connected it before for some reason.
And then so
I've been very little.
You had this sort of, you know, hearing these little stories, but how did your kind of gradual, you know, the tractor beam towards the business pull you? So, I mean, did you... Because I think I'm right in saying you went on to study fine art at college.
Yeah,
is that right.
And I think it's one of those things that if you're not that academic, and you can draw, you sort of end up doing art of some sort. So started off doing fine art, and then drifted over to graphics because there was probably more money in graphics than fine art, particularly if you'd seen my fine art. sort of studied that for a bit, and it was at the time it was very. Fiddly. It wasn't as exciting as graphics appears now.
Yeah.
It was all, you know, is Gaudi a better font than Baskerville? And it was all like detail-y stuff. Now, at that time, I think about 84-85, advertising was incredibly glamorous. You'd have people like John Hegarty was on Wogan.
Yeah.
Primetime Wogan.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, absolutely. I always felt sorry for Wogan because,
yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
No disrespect to John, but I mean, compared to Pelé or...
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, so, and then obviously you would have had Saatchi and Saatchi supposedly getting Margaret Thatcher in was the sort of way it was reported.
Yeah.
And then there was just a whole bunch of work, you know, that was the time when everybody would say the ads are better than the programmes.
Yeah.
You know, so people would look forward to the... bits in
and
the program.
Remember that yourself when you were growing up? So
I totally remember as everybody my age does, all of John Webster's
John's,
work being on TV, lots of the CDP work being on TV, and it was on a basic level it made you like the brands. So if you saw, and I'm saying this because I've recently interviewed Alan Parker, if you saw a Texaco ad with Morecambe and Wise on it, you can't help but think Texaco are quite cool, aren't they? Rather than whoever their rival is. I think it was kind of a bigger part of culture then, advertising. certainly through the 70s and 80s, because obviously there was less distractions. There was no gaming, there was no internet, there was no... So it played a bigger part in culture. So I kind of remember liking all that stuff, as a lot of people did in those days. Anyway, so so I went to college and did graphics. Left there and got a sort of... replied to a job that was like T-boy or something, to get into a studio. And you would do these things like make PMTs, which means nothing probably to most people listening. Which essentially a bit like a high-class version of photocopying. Diddle around. And then I used to get given, I can't remember how, but they would, eventually they thought he's quite good at ideas. So I'd get given a sort of briefs to design logos. They'd probably give it to some proper designers, but they'd say, can you think of anything on this? Yeah. And obviously I'd... didn't really know what I was doing, but I'd come up with the ideas. Through that, I started reading the magazines that they'd have, primarily Creative Review, which showed you a little bit about behind advertising. I thought, well, that just seems so much more, seems bigger and more fun. You know, design to me at that time seemed like noodling away with little pens and diddling around with little tiny bits of crafty nonsense. It didn't seem like ideas, and this idea could be seen by, you know, the whole country. It was like you might design a little ink pot that might end up on the shelves, and you go, well, it was going to be Bodoni. I actually switched it to Gaudi, so that was the that's the big input I had. So it just felt like so unexpressive and fiddly and nothingy.
So where? So what? The company that you first, your first job, what was that called?
That was called Parallel Communications.
No longer with us?
No longer with us. Right. Yeah, it only lasted a little while, and it was barely a company, really. It's a couple of blokes at the back end of a typesetting studio. So very kind of, 50 quid a week, I think I got.
But gave you access to
But it sort of gave me access to magazines. I could see some stuff around. The guys in the type company... what would it be? Type Company makes it sound like it was quite creative. It was more of a mechanicals setting company. Studio. You know, they'd sort of took me under their wing a bit and would show me some stuff, introduce me to a few people, some sort of LP designers. One of which was the guy who did the Rolling Stones tongue thing.
Right, yeah.
Probably got 50 quid for it as well back in the day. But... So I'd kind of meet some of these people, which felt like it was a much more expressive thing. I suppose it felt like the creativity that they were doing was a bit more personal.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, so it was useful in a way. I mean, I it got that, me, you know.
I think anywhere always is. There's always, you look back.
Yeah, you always pick up something from it.
While you're there, you might be thinking, got to get out, got to get out. But when you're out and you look back, you go, well, actually, there was that and that and that, and that was really useful. And
yeah. My only memory of it now is sitting there into the night, like, 12, 1 o'clock in the studio, coming up with ideas while listening to David Bowie compilation tapes.
Really?
Yeah.
Good preparation for Ligas Delaney.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So I did the same there, yeah.
So, just give us an idea then. So you decide that you want to get into this other world. How did you go about making that happen? Because I saw I read a lovely thing where you'd done the... you'd done a kind of a letter where you'd crossed out.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, so, dear Mr... You know, and then
I think... My memory is that it's a bit hazy, but that Parallel Communications either folded or couldn't afford me or whatever the thing was. And I thought, I want to switch to advertising. It just seems more interesting. But I knew nothing about it at all. So being a kind of chronic hoarder, I've still got these kind of lists of, it will say, St. Legas Delaney, Ian Fleming Associates, which is an illustrator's agent. Mm. Someone else who's a PR company. I mean, I didn't really know the difference between all of these.
Yeah.
And I would send out letters to all these people, not having a clue of how you get any response. I mean, I'd never been to sort of Watford or any of those.
Yeah.
And I can't remember what I would have written, but essentially probably saying I'm really hardworking and really, really want a job there. And, you know, it would have been that low-level stuff. And I would... hand draw all the sort of ads that would be complete one-off things. I think of an idea for something, draw it, and that's one, and then I might think of two ideas for something else. It was like a complete cobbled load of random stuff. Some of it was, I would have just done a version of something that I really liked that was real. Anyway, so that I would send these out, hand-drawn things that would take ages to do and all coloured in, and I would get nothing back at all. No one would even say, I wouldn't even know it had arrived.
Yeah.
So in a slight fit of desperation, I kind of thought, what the hell can I do? So in trying to write another letter, that I can't really change the work much. Maybe I can change the letter. And I couldn't really think of what to write. You know, there's a sort of bit in Woody Allen's Manhattan. I don't know if you've seen that, where he's trying to write the beginning of the film and he keeps rewriting it sort of badly and, you know. Anyway, so I kind of, partly through inspiration for that, and the fact that I just didn't know whether to be very formal,
because they were quite
high class
creative
people. They thought, this guy runs X. Yeah. Should I be all formal or should I be really friendly?
Yeah.
So I have no fucking idea. I don't know. I've never met anyone who does that job. So I did a letter that went from incredibly formal as can be, crossed out, and then it got friendly and friendly until I was almost like giddy. Drunk. Hey, I think there's one John Webster would say, Johnny Baby or something, blah, blah, blah. Partly out of desperation, really. I mean, in a way, it was a sort of quite a neat idea, but it was true. It come from a truth that I didn't know what the hell, how to talk to them. And I got a lot of responses. So it was exactly the same work, but people wrote back. They just thought, I think partly because you're revealing a bit of yourself, possibly, and possibly because it's obviously a bit funny. So that got me lots of letters, at least, back, and a few interviews, yeah.
Yeah. And so the, is it Brooks Legon Bloomfield?
Yeah, the famous Brooks Legon Bloomfield.
Yeah. So that was, you got an interview there.
So that was one of the interviews I had, yeah. I think, yeah, I would lug around the big... I think I remember you talking about your big A1 case. Yeah. So mine wouldn't be as glamorous as those metal ones, but it was a big A1 black folder that I would lug about. so I kind of went into there in Maddox Street, had an interview with a guy in a wheelchair who was creative director, who said, you know, get your portfolio out, lay it on the side, and he kind of went through... I think at this point I'd probably be looking around in advertising... Been unemployed for about a year, sending out letters, trying to think of ads, diddling around. Anyway, so you kind of, like all people when you're doing placement or you're in that situation, you think it's like waiting for a bus. You think, any minute now, I'll get offered a job. This is probably next week, so there's no point quitting now.
That's the only thing that sustains you, is that crazy.
If I stopped now, I would have got a job next week. So you kind of, anyway, he went through all the stuff and he said, sort of criticised lots of stuff. now, I wouldn't have known the difference between him, Barry Brooks and John Hegarty.
Yeah.
At the time, it was a guy running a creative department. And then at the end, he said, look, you know, maybe you should think about going to college, which is a heartbreaking thing.
Yeah.
You know, you're a year in. You're weeks away from getting a job. Maybe you should, he must have said, maybe you should just give up and do something else. So he said, maybe you should go to college and, you know, it might help. So out of desperation, I said, have you got a brief I could work on at least? Because I'm really, you know, I'm making this stuff up.
Yeah.
Might be good to see a real brief. And
Findus?
Yeah. So he kind of reached for the nearest bit of paper, which luckily happened to be a brief, that he said, yeah, there you go. So so anyway, so I went out, read the brief outside, Findus, Frozen Monge 2.
Rodders.
Yeah, which obviously now I realise is a horrific brief, but at the time it was a real one, so you think that's great. Stayed up, worked, you know, all the week, just idea after idea, all garbage, but just as another one.
Yeah.
I had no idea really what I was doing, but I could do lots of them. So then the following week I had another interview, I think it was at TBWA. Went from there back into Maddox Street with this guy to show him all this stuff that I'd done. You know, I'd booked in a meeting with him. Went into his room and he said, right, put, get, put your folio on there. So I thought, that's weird. He said, do you want to unzip it? And I thought, yeah, God, it's annoying, because he's seen that already, but if he wants to refresh his mind. So he went through it again, and he said, you see that one? I think you should do that. And he started going through the same things again. And obviously it dawned on me that
he didn't have
not only could he not remember giving me the brief, he couldn't remember seeing me the week before.
Yeah, brilliant.
So, you know, I was pretty shy, thinking, how the fuck do I say, you idiot, you saw me last week.
I've got to get from there to show him the Finder stuff. Yeah, that's the goal here.
Exactly. I've got to get from not making him feel bad. So, obviously he must have said something like, well, thanks for reminding me of that.
Looking at it again.
That's really good. And obviously I did bring the stuff back that you asked me to do. And he was like, let's have a look at that. I kind of went through, and I gave him a massive literally a massive, massive wad of paper, all garbage. And I just remember him looking at two. There must have been, God, who knows, 200 bits of paper. Looked at two, and then he was just flicking the, I can't think how you describe that in audio, but he was like flicking the edge of the paper to get a quantity, you know, thinking, like you'd flick notes or something like that, thinking,
right. Checking, there's a lot there. 300 quid
there's a lot there. And I think also probably partly now feeling guilty that he can't even remember giving me the brief or seeing me, and I've come in and I've done a lot of work. He went, why don't you come in for a couple of weeks and see how you get on? So the combination of those, him forgetting, me just endlessly producing probably garbage, but loads of it. And then that letter sort of got me that trial for a couple of weeks.
Yeah. It's a great story because it is... I mean, I remember that stage very clearly. And I was in account management, and John Bacon, I couldn't get him to see me, and I was the floor above.
And you were in the same building?
Yeah. And then someone told me, oh, he collects watches. And I knew someone who collected watches. Yeah. And I said, what's the best watch magazine, you know, you can buy? And I wrapped a note around that saying, you'll find 10 minutes to read this. Can't you find 10 minutes to see it? Sure enough, 10 seconds later, ring, ring, come down. And but
it's an interest. The same thing that actually I think most people starting in the business imagine that they're going to do something so amazing that people are going to just go,
but
wow,
half the time these
here.
Guys aren't even reading it. You know, they're thinking, shit, we haven't got anything to launch the Ford Fiesta next month.
Exactly.
Oh, Christ, and I've agreed to see this. And the sort of look.
So getting in via that sort of other means of either just.
But if you look at your ingredients, the letter is insightful, it's funny, it's self-deprecating. And then the massive, massive amount of work. I mean, that's what you want. A little spark and the ability to just stay till 2 in the morning and keep going. So So the trial led to a job.
So the trial, So on my trial, the first thing brief I was given was they used to do things in magazines, they probably still do, where they'd say solicitors are now going to be able to advertise, or there's a law going through, or it may go through. Can you submit some ads to show the kind of things that they may do? So on my first day, I got a brief for vets are now going to be allowed to advertise. You know, can you do some ads of what they may do? So again, I just thought of as many things as I possibly could. And a few people in the agency worked on it, and mine were some of the ones that went over.
Yeah.
There was a dog cocking its front leg up, and it said, if your dog's got problems, bring them to us. And I can still remember there was a debate amongst the writers saying, should it be bring them to us or bring it to us? Bring the problems to us or bring the dog to us? Get off, no idea. A goldfish swimming upside down and some other stuff. And they sent them all in, and they printed the ones that I'd done in the magazine, like 2 weeks in. So that then they then said, why don't you stay a bit longer for another month? And then in that month, they had a brief for a product called Hippopotamus. Do you know that? Do you remember that?
I don't.
You don't. So it's a Shambulsi product.
With an animated hippo.
With an animated hippo, So they said, do you want to work on this? So I kind of, not having written any TV or knowing what I was doing, remembered the sort of Fantasia thing for some reason and did a version of that. There was no particular idea in it. Just thought it'd be funny to have lots of hippos.
Yeah.
Swimming and
falling into
being like Busby Berkeley, I think. But there was no, I didn't think I wrote an end line or anything threading any of it. So I did all these drawings of it. And that ended up getting made. So then that got me like a three. So it went from 2 weeks to a month to 3 months, because that was then being made, and that ended up, yeah, just staying there. So yeah, that kind of carried me through.
I think I should say at this point as well that I did during this process, I emailed Dave and said, look, you know, I've got all the annuals and I'm online, and obviously I can piece the portfolio together, but just because I'm bone idle, I wonder if you know, have you got it in one place? And he emailed me back saying, yes, I have. I can get it over to you by Friday. But by the way, there's quite a lot of it. So when I received it, I began to go through it, and every rough
that you nearly every rough
I know. That you've ever drawn, or I mean, it people say about your, you know, your blog, oh, I sort of went in to read this or whatever and got lost. I mean, I've been lost in your portfolio a number of times in the last couple of weeks. And the thing, one of the things I seem to have a date, and we are skipping ahead here. I had a date for 1992, Simons Palmer.
Yeah.
But before that,
there's a lot of rubbish agencies.
Well, there's five agencies, so, well, I've got Brooks Legal in Bloomfield. I've got Cromer Titterton. Yep. I've got Edwards Martin Thornton. I've got Publicis. I've got Delaney Fletcher, Delaney Bozell, right. And then you hit Simons Palmer.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's very confusing. I mean, my first recollection of you was, and I think it was, it might have been, I can't remember, 92, the annual. And there's a trade ad for, I think, Tennent's Low Alcohol Lager. And it's on its side and it says Best Before. And then instead of a date, it lists all the competitors, you know, number one selling. Lovely. I remember that. But then you move to the poster section and you've got a very nice ad for the IPA in there with pencils, which is credited to Publicis. So, I mean, we can come back and go through all of these. But so where did you go next?
So basically, I was at Brooks Legal Bloomfield for 3 years. So basically, I virtually only did TV, weirdly.
Yeah.
Because they didn't trust me to art direct things. Probably I've tried to overcompensate since. But they would always give they'd think he's good at ideas, and then they would give them to a lovely girl called Sally, who would sort of draw them up and then art direct them.
Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah, so as I said, I've probably tried to overcompensate for that. But I'd just do TV. So I did loads of TV, and it was always quite sort of adventurous, but there would be no chance of it ever coming out good in retrospect. So I'd be trying to do Jean-Paul Goude-style commercials at this agency that did Findus Lean Cuisine and Sarsen's Vinegar, you know, it was like. But some of it, funnily enough, would get made, and I'd get Nick Lewin shooting it. But it, you know, you can't just knock off a Jean-Paul Goude, you know, on a budget for Hot Point.
Also, you're not going to do it if it's your first job, unless someone leading the agency is saying, "We're doing Jean-Paul Goude. I'll help you get there."
Yeah,
you can't. You're not gonna...
I had no clues, but I made lots of TV. But eventually, I got fired. I didn't really. 3 years in, I was probably a bit cocky. I'd made tons of work, particularly for there. I don't exactly know why. Maybe they lost business, or maybe I don't know. So I got fired, and then at that point, I was just an art director called Brian Stewart I was seeing with my work. Said you should get together with this writer called Alistair Wood, who you know,
and Brian as well. I know Brian as well.
Do you know Brian?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So Brian lives down near me in
does he?
In Sussex. Yeah.
Oh well, he was really helpful to me. So he. Sort of, well, there's another agency that I technically could put on that list. So basically, I got fired from there, went around to see Brian at Elgie Stewart Smith, and said, "Look, I've got nothing to do. I've been fired from that place. I used to go and show Brian my book, and he'd say, come back. I said, can I kick around here and do some ads for free? Because otherwise, I'm just going to be sitting at home. So I was at Elgie Stewart Smith in their loft when they started. They're in Margaret Street. Work kind of a bit like when I started. I was just sitting on my own doing loads of ideas. And one of those, funnily enough, I was going to say the ones that the ads that you mentioned were the first that I got in the book. It wasn't. There was before that, I'd done a radio ad at Elgie Stewart Smith. So I'd done a poster that was like the end of the Whartons, and it was just a sea of good night with different names. And it said, if you're looking for a bigger house, take a look in the Observer.
I love this. It's all.
our most highly awarded art director currently working, got in the book first for radio and wasn't allowed to art direct any of his
acts. Exactly. His first I haven't art directed anything yet at this point. Well, ironically, so I did that as a poster and they all liked it. They presented it and it came back as a radio ad. So the account man said, great, good and bad news. The good news is they loved it. The bad news is it's a radio ad now.
I
thought was no use to me at the time. Because radio, who wants radio? Yeah. Nobody even listened to anyone's radio in the book. So, and that ended up getting in the book. So I was there for like 3 months. Brian was sort of trying to hook me up with a writer he thought was really good called Alistair Wood. So we'd work together after work. And then a job come up at Cromer Titterton for a guy who used to run... who used to be Dave Waters' partner at GGT called Jan van Mestek.
Yeah.
Had taken it over to sort of change and stuff. So we went there.
You and Alistair.
Me and Alistair. Yeah. Worked really well together, did a ton of stuff, and then we both got fired from there. I can't remember why. I didn't really know what happened there. But we were there about 18 months. Then I got a job at Edwards Martin Thornton, mm-hmm. which was, I don't know whether, do you know who they are? The names? So basically, when Bogle Hegarty left TBWA,
yeah.
Edwards Martin Thornton were all the other half of the. So Chris Martin was John Hegarty's writer.
Right.
Bob Edwards was probably Bogle's deputy, and Chris Martin ran the media department. Media, so they were like almost the next generation. Didn't quite happen for them really, but anyway, so I was there for a couple of years when I did that ad, the beer one, which ended up in the book. And then at that point I was working late nights with a really good writer called Mike McKenna.
Yeah.
And we'd get together and work on these IPA posters. Did you ever do an IPA
DCI
poster?
DCI McKenna.
DCI
used
McKenna.
Used to be cool.
Yeah.
He's about 6'5" and
more, I think.
Is he? Yeah.
Because
you did that, the IPA thing, as a kind of bit of freelance.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's lots of, I think Alistair and Mike used to try and, yeah, I think the IPA posters were like photocopies of information, and they'd suggested that why don't you, for 50 quid or 100 quid, you could actually do a poster. We'd get a poster we could enter and put in a book, and you have a poster for the pinboards that go all around London. You've got a captive audience of all the people that you're showing your book to. Why don't we start doing them as posters? I think they knew Chris Thomas and whoever was on the IPA committee. So they started that, and then one of the briefs came out that Alistair was away, so I worked with it on Mike, and we did a poster that wasn't at Publicis that ended up getting in the book twice, I think. And then for some reason, because we joined Publicis, we thought it was a good gesture to put their name on it. So we put their name on it.
But it's an interesting stage, isn't it? Because Brian is a very good art director.
Yeah.
And you know, he's a great fun and an interesting guy, and one of those people I think that sort of that real burst of creativity where they were able to, in advertising, work with fabulous photographers. And so you're starting to mix with or be influenced by a good art director, and then Alistair and Mike are both went on throughout their creativity, and stuff. So
it's a different world from Brooks League and Bloomfield.
Exactly, you're knocking about with a different level, a strata of talent.
And certainly Brian, I think he's really good. He's funny. He's not as known. There's a few art directors I know, like John Knight and Brian and a few others, who were really good and are really sort of respected, but they're not quite as known as some others. And I mean, Brian was very good.
Yeah, I encountered Brian when I first became a creative director at Rainey Kelly, and I was so sort of racked with the whole thing that I just didn't really enjoy. I didn't take full advantage of the fact that we had this great guy, and that he was doing a bit on Land Rover, and then I did a sort of bit of research on him, and then I got to meet him down in Sussex, and
he was at Rainey Kelly.
Robert and Mark used to get him in to do Land Rover, to look after Land Rover. And he used to come and see me, and what can I do, and this and that. But I was sort of, I had different accounts, and I was like, shit, you've got to make this work. And I was very serious, I think, at the time.
Yeah.
And I see him now in Sussex, and you go around to his house, and he's got all these brilliant photographs and great stories, and you have a bottle of wine with him. And he's the real deal. So, so I can imagine him being very helpful and encouraging, you know.
Yeah. He was very, he's funny in a way, because he's very, what's the word? Abrasive to some people.
Ooh.
But he was very encouraging and and nurturing to me as a sort of young guy trying to get into somewhere good and trying to get somewhere. He was really, really, really helpful. I remember him saying, "You should, you know what you should buy? You should buy an Irving Penn cigarette. You pick up one now for..." It was literally like £1,000, but then it was like saying to a student, "When you buy an Irving Penn cigarette, you probably get one for £10,000." It's like, so it was such a ridiculous thing to say. Whereas now you think it's probably £100,000.
Yeah.
And so there, even then, he was saying you should buy this, you should buy that. I didn't have the money to buy any of these things.
Yeah.
But no, he was one of the first people I met who was on that different level of being, knew what he was doing and
absolutely,
was good and been around good places and good people.
Good people. I think that's the thing I always notice about him. Whenever he's telling you a story about, "Oh, I did this or I did that," it's a bit like Arden was at times, actually, sort of a magnet for good, interesting people to work with, and Brian Griffin, people like that. So, right, where are we up to?
So you've done
Chromatid and you've done Edwards Montethorpe. You're now in at Publicis, working with Alistair?
No.
Mike?
We tried to get a job together, me and Alistair, because we worked really well together and liked working together, but we sort of got split up. I think something came up for Alistair at Dorlands, and I then went to Edwards Martin Thornton. So in the meantime, because I'd done that thing with Mike, the IPA, we'd done a bit more work together, and two jobs came up for me. One was at Chite Day when it was being run by Kez and John.
Yep.
And one was through Barry Smith, who I knew through Ogie Stewart Smith.
Yep.
So one was for a team with me and Mike at Publicis, and the other was just for me on my own to work with a guy who's now a director called David Shane. I don't know if you know David Shane.
Yeah.
It was to work with him. So I had a sort of conflicted thing that I'd put a lot of energy into working with Mike and doing a team thing and finding a job, and he's huge.
Yeah, I don't want to tell him.
And then on the other hand, Chart Day was a very cool, funky... Kez and John had just done Dan Busters,
yeah,
I think,
were...
and the guy was, David Shane, was supposed to be really good from, I think he's from Chart Day over there, and he was either going to leave or he wanted to go to a different office, and he was coming to London. And he seemed nice. In the end, I went for this sort of, it'd be better not to tell someone who's 6'8", you're going to ditch him after a year. So partly that, partly I knew Barry Smith, and I thought, anyway, so I went to Publicis. But when we got there, we found out that we were in the international department, which then was literally, we were
Renault.
The floor below. It was like upstairs, downstairs.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So we went to a publicist that had just been left by Tim Mellors that was quite glitzy. So the two guys in the international department were, a lot of the creative people didn't even talk to us. It's like they're in international.
Yeah.
But Barry said, "Look, we'll sort it out. You know, come over, we can get you in here and then we'll figure it out somehow." So there was a sort of few weeks of thinking, what the hell have I done? Could have been at Chiat Day and I've ended up in Publicis International working on, funnily enough, Intel was one of the accounts, but it was working on a lot of seemingly terrible stuff. And all the people upstairs didn't, it was incredibly snobby. It literally wouldn't look at us. It was bizarre.
I love that, though, because then, you know, fast forward however many years. And...
yeah, it's weird. I mean, it's all good lessons that you think...
yeah, oh, yeah.
Never behave like that.
Absolutely.
And also, in a way, sometimes those things are helpful because it makes you really, really want to do good work, you know. It makes you really want to do something that gets in the book or gets noticed or something, more than the people who are swanning about, not doing any work, but
just giving
ignoring
attitude.
You.
Yeah, exactly. So, and did they migrate you? Did you manage to...
So they did. At some point, I can't remember how long, maybe like 9 months in or 6 months in, they folded the international department into the main department. And we were sort of all one. So we would just work on anything and everything. So we would always be asking for briefs. Anything. Literally, if it was, you know... 2-inch 0% finance.
Yeah.
Anything. We had unrealistic sort of ideas about what we could do, but there's nothing that would be too bad that we would work on. So I remember once and this is in the days when 5 grand was, I'm just trying to think, is it less than it is now? We had a 30-second radio ad for Ireland to be shot. You didn't have a film budget. You had $5,000, and we thought, okay, so what can we do? So $5,000 then was probably less than that. I mean, I'm just trying to think. Nobody made ads for $5,000 then. Mm. And it was only to run in Ireland, and we couldn't shoot anything. But we thought, yeah, we can do something. What can we do? We've got titles. We've got this. So we would take on anything going. And obviously that, in an environment that was quite...
People are definitely not proactive. They're very kind of...
So basically that then caused a lot of people to not like us even more. Yeah. It's like they don't go to lunch. They really work late.
Yeah.
They work on anything. They're always trying to do something good. You know, what's their problem? So that was, with a lot of the people who had been there for years and would sort of, you know, stop work at 12:30 for the day. He really didn't like that. So we probably worked harder there than anywhere on some degree. Partly because I guess it's pre-having kids and you're desperately trying to move on and up. So I think we were there for about 2 years. Yeah.
And so I'm trying to pick through this. So then Delaney Fletcher Delaney.
So then Delaney Fletcher Delaney, which was Brian.
Which is, I was going to say,
so
Brian.
Then I'd kept in touch with Brian, and he would say, I'll try and get you in here, or, you know, so he would see me throughout, he'd give me advice, and he'd say, perhaps I can get you over here. And at the time, he'd made a big impact there, he was doing a lot of stuff. And he eventually, after nagging Greg or whatever, it sort of seemed to go on a long time, he got us in. So we started. So that felt like a big step up from Publicist, which was sort of going down and down at the time. It had been good under Tim Mellis.
But when I went through the archive, you've only got one ad.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm wading through roughs and stuff like that, it's two separate things. I clicked it. It's just the same ad, different ways round. You know, yeah. One's vertical,
which did you
one's
prefer?
Horizontal. I thought they were both much of a matchness. Very nice, but...
We did more than one ad there, but I think I was only there for 3 months. So 3 months in, and again, that felt like it was going well because Brian was, we had his sort of backing and he was very encouraging and we had loads of bruises. So it was going very well, but 3 months in, at the same time, we'd been seeing lots of other agencies, obviously, and we used to see Simons Palmer a lot.
Yeah.
So, as you know, I think lots of people had this experience. So they'd go and see Chris and Mark late after work down in the basement in their sort of sofa area, go through their book, hear nothing, and then you might get another call a few months later and you think, well, they know our work, so it must be a job. See them, same process, nothing. Anyway, we'd had that a few times with Chris and Mark, and then we went to Delaney Fletcher. 3 months in or so, I got a call, I think it was Andy Mackay, said, do you want to come in and see Chris and Mark? So I said, yeah. He said, it's just you this time. I said, oh, right. I said, well, we've only just joined. What's the... He went, well, we need an art director for Mark Goodwin. So I said, oh, I'm going to have to say no. Ridiculous, really. But the mindset is... it's hard to explain now because, both of those things, the Chite Day thing and the Simons Palmer, you think, obviously you have to do that. The difference is like... It's like being at Tranmere and Man United. You don't go, I've only just joined Tranmere. So I said, I suppose I felt bad for Brian. He'd spent a long time trying to get us in. And it's awkward. And then it's only, so the guy I'm sitting opposite isn't coming. Brian's tried to get, so I just felt really bad. I said, I think I'll have to say no. It's such a pain because I'd really like to work there. But we'll think about it. And then I think I spoke to Mark. And eventually,
Denton.
Obviously. Yeah.
Yeah.
And eventually, and I told Mark, I said, I'm sure he would have said, you've got to take it. So eventually, obviously, I thought, I've been working now, I think at that point, 7 years.
Yeah.
It's like the best agency in the country.
Hottest agency in the country.
Yeah. Well, I can't not. It's ridiculous. What's the point in working hard and trying to get this out and that out? So I kind of told Brian, which was almost worse in a way than telling Mike. I don't know, because he'd made a big effort to get us there. He didn't take it very well. They said, "Look, they're about to fold. They only do one style of work." There was like he had loads of reasons why. Yeah. It's a terrible thing. Obviously, it's partly a pride thing. And he said, "Okay, before you do it, I want you to write a list of the pros and cons, and then let's go through it together." So I did that, and obviously that's slightly tricky because you've got to go through it.
Yeah, you can't be witheringly honest.
Quality of work, them amazing, you bit shit.
Yeah,
you know, so you partly got to write it for the audience.
Yeah.
You, really good. Them, possibly even better. Yeah. So I had to go through this sort of list of all the pros and cons, which he then obviously disagreed with loads of them. And then it was... then eventually it was a bit of a tussle. He was like quite... He made it tricky.
Yeah.
Which I'll probably take as a compliment now. But, it was difficult.
Did you... Did you patch that up with him later? Or was it? Yeah.
He was fine. Yeah. Yeah.
He's a good guy.
The thing that got us into Simons Palmer was all the non-agency work we'd done.
Yeah, but that was their, their reputation was someone from less fashionable agencies. Here's six or seven things I've actually made, and here's 200 roughs at the back that show you.
No, but these were real, these were made. So, right. So from the sort of IPA ad onwards, partly Mike was more into that vibe and I got into it, which was you'd approach companies like Boxing News or O'Connor Dowse, the retouching.
Yeah.
Anyone who wanted an ad, you'd go, we'll do it absolutely for nothing and we'll pull in favours from photographers if you let us do what we want.
Yeah.
So we ended up doing a lot of those. And if you took those out of our book, I would never have got into Simon's Palmer.
Yeah.
So it ended up being a really useful thing.
But that's a... Yeah, it's a big deal at that stage to walk into that agency. So who was there? Who was it? What was the department?
I think Tony Barry had just gone. So Mark Goodwin, who I was working with, Andy Mackay. I think Tim Riley had just gone.
Tiger
and Silverman.
Yeah.
Guy and Tony.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. It might only have been that. I'm trying to think whether there was any more than that. There wasn't many. And Chris and Mark, obviously, who would work on the briefs against you sometimes. Horrifically.
So you got in there. And so how long were you there before Chris and Mark went?
I was there, I think it was 10 months.
Right.
So I loved it there because I'd spent all that time trying to get someone like that. And what I noticed is sort of nothing happened. You just went into your office. Barely anyone came in. There was no, let's have a meeting on this. You just sit in your room doing ideas. And then at the end of the day, Chris and Mark would come in, look at your wall that you've covered. And then sometimes what I noticed is that it's almost like the agencies I was at got slightly better in tiny little increments until I got to there. And in the first ones, there would be lots of chat that you would have to try and think, God, what does that word mean? I'll look that up. And, you know, you'd have to think about it a lot. And then when I got to there, Chris and Mark would come in, look at the wall and go, yeah, I don't know, keep going, maybe. I don't know if there's anything funny. Do you know what I mean? There was like no science. There was no, but they were right. It's like we know what the brief is. Yeah. We know. I don't really like anything.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't. Sometimes just go, and then they leave.
Yeah.
But so it was interesting to me that was like the best work in the country at the time, and there was no. It's not loads of words surrounding it. It was just.
It's a simple business, isn't it? Actually,
but not many people are confident enough to. Be that simple or that precise, whatever it is. So we would do that every day. It was like very almost cozy, strange. You never met clients. I don't think even Mark went to client meetings.
Yeah,
there would be no brainstorms or My memory is just going in the office, only leaving to make tea, just scribbling all day, and then Chris and Mark would review at the end of every day.
Yeah. Bless something or tell you to keep going. And you worked on The Sun, The News of the World, Nike.
Sun, News of the World, Nike, a thing called Telly Millions.
Because I remember things like, maybe I've got it wrong, but Spanked and stuff. So, yeah. Some stuff that I suspect now we could say some quite un-Dave Dye kind of stuff.
Well, I think it's interesting that because I can remember... When they pitched for The Sun, they were known for doing all that cool stuff like Wrangler and Nike particularly. And then The Sun was like probably almost viewed like the star now. It's like really trashy. You think, what the hell are they going to do with that rag? And what they did, which was a really good lesson, is they just represented, they didn't try and make them seem cool. They just went with what they were.
Well, they pulled the paper through into the advertising.
So it was all very brash and in your face, and which was totally appropriate.
But also a lot of trade stuff. So all those media buyers are loving it. Loving, you know, like pictures of spank bums and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. It's like bragging rights over.
Well, I think it's one of those things Mark always used to say, that when it's as if there's something in the water when you're at a place that your work always becomes very much like that. So when he was at BBH, it was like BBH, and then when he went to Lowe's, it sort of changed.
Yeah,
I mean the slightly more simpler version is they buy the ads, so you've got no choice. You know, we would have done on things like Spanx a ton of stuff, and sometimes they'd go that one with the arsenic. Yeah. I think, really, and then it ended up in the book.
Yeah.
But so they're very much, you know, there would be no. I can't think of there'd be any leeway with, well, we really like this, or, you know, it's like you produce loads of paper and scripts and whatever, and then sometimes they'd hustle them all together, go in their room, come out, and then it's that. It wasn't really a debate. Sometimes there'd be a wall, you know, there was a wall, as you remember, I think you mentioned.
Yeah, the central wall, yeah.
And in theory, I suppose that was, the theory was that this is what's going on, which I really like, and you know what you've got to beat. But obviously, the whether X beats Y is unbelievably subjective. You know, it's not.
But it's for a creative person, in a funny way, it's something quite comforting about that existence for a while. That there's no questioning, there's no debate.
Yeah.
You just go in, you get on your wheel, you generate as much as possible. And then someone, it relies on you believing in the people who are coming in and going, that one, end of chat. Now,
well, at the time for me, it was great because also they would be picking things that I wouldn't necessarily. The Spanked one, left to my own devices, I probably wouldn't pick.
Yeah.
There was a Nike one that I thought, Cobblers. And I thought, it's all right, it's not great. There was like, so they would pick, sometimes they would pick, maybe they were the best of the bunch, I can't remember what was around them, but they would pick these things, I don't know, and they'd all get in the book. So in a way, at that point, you think, fine, I'll keep writing and throwing stuff out. They can pick whatever they want to pick, and they end up winning awards.
Yeah,
but it wasn't, I had no shaping or control over it. I'd just sort of go with, they're the bosses, I'll give them enough fuel. And
but at the right stage of your career, I mean, I talked to you about the Steve Dunn, when we were at Lowe's, that's what we used to do. It's there'd be no chat. He'd pretend, Steve would always say, what do you think? And he'd normally interrupt you halfway through, just say, it's that one. But I found that, I couldn't have done it for my whole career, but I had 3 years, I found that very comforting.
Yeah.
I trusted him completely. Whenever he picked one, we always got a silver at campaign posters. So you were sort of, so you've got this, you've moved through these agencies, you've endured, getting fired twice. You've been working every hour that God sends, and then you finally make it to the promised land, the hottest agency in the country, and it revolved around Chris and Mark. And then 10 months in, they're removed from their own agency. It must have been pretty traumatic for everyone there. I mean, particularly them, obviously. But
yeah, particularly for the creatives.
Yeah.
Because you didn't deal with the clients, for a start. You dealt with the account people a bit, but not as much as you do today or in other agencies probably at that time. So it was very insular. You're in your room showing them stuff. That was the relationship. It was, it was kind of annoying when... whoops.
It's Chris or Mark.
to say. How are you doing?
I'm all right. You doing okay?
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Right, so what was I saying?
Well, just sex, but yeah, you make it to the promised land and you've got this very intense relationship with them. You're just working, showing them work, and then suddenly they're dragged out of the building. And
yeah, so that was really, it was kind of annoying, really, because it felt like I'd finally got on track. I was producing a lot of stuff and it was starting to win things and getting, or even the stuff that I didn't really love was getting in. I mean, that's partly a thing of when agencies get very hot.
Yeah.
You know, they just get the benefit of the doubt on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And I was getting the benefit of that. And then all of a sudden, yeah, I get a phone call from Mark saying, oh, by the way, we've been fired. Which was, yeah, it was kind of annoying. You know, obviously I felt bad for them. But I also thought, that's so, you know, 10 months in.
And then, but also, I mean, for us, on the outside, I think the creative community was kind of outraged because they were, you know, they were just brilliant and it was the best place to work. But then you had this whole equally difficult thing where they were replaced, and they were replaced by people who'd been part of the kind of inner sanctum. And I know you speak to a lot of people who were there who were Chris and Mark devotees, that suddenly you were working into people who, and that felt really rough, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's ultimately, at that point, Mark Goodwin had left, I think, after 6 months. He'd put up with me for 6 months, and then he'd left to go and work with his old partner at BBH. So I was in the process of, Tony Barry was going to come back to Simon's Palmer to work with me, and we'd sort of had a lot of meetings about that, and he was coming back. And this happened just in this the middle of this thing. And God, sorry.
And where was Tony? Was Tony?
So sorry, Tony was at Leagas Delaney.
Yeah.
So the thing that you were just saying about the people there. So it was very confusing because they had such a massive hold on the agency. It was partly probably to do with them going, but and then some of the people in the creative department said, "Look, we're sort of." We want you to say, we've been speaking to the partners, you know, you're one of the people that we don't know what happened either. Can you sort of bear with us? And, you know, and they'd say, I don't know what happened, you know, trust me. And then you'd hear things, you think, well, that person did know.
Did know what happened.
You know, they seemed, supposedly they voted against them. It was all a bit, and I thought, I don't really know who's done what or I don't really know what's happened. So I said to Tony Lott, the thing I forgot to mention before is when I was offered, a bit like you, when you got your week at Simon's Palmer, it led to you getting a job.
Yeah.
When I got offered a job, I'd spent 7 years seeing, I must have seen John Hegarty 7 times. I'd seen everyone. And they'd all, sometimes, you know, they'd be, let me think about it at the weekend. No. But so I felt like I was close to lots of places, but no one would commit. I think partly because I was at, you know, it's difficult to hire someone at Cromer Tudston if you're at BBH or whatever. Yeah. You know, it seems like a risk. Anyway, so I just couldn't break through. And then when I was offered a job at Simon's Palmer, within a day I was offered a job at Leagas Delaney and BBH.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it?
And you think, oh, I've waited 7 years to try and get in someone like that, and now I can't take either of those.
Because
anyway, but so when the thing happened with Chris and Mark, I said to Tony, I really don't know what's happening here. It's all very, I don't know who to trust. I don't know who's done what. I don't know how it's going to be. Why don't I come there?
Yeah.
Why don't? Because I know Tim wanted to hire me before. If you're there and on your own as a writer, maybe he might hire me there. So he spoke to Tim. I went in to see Tim. And he said, yeah, you know, come here. And I remember saying, okay, have you got something in writing or something? And he sort of just laughed and picked up a piece of paper and scrawled, I'm offering you a job. And he was sort of just laughing as if.
Because so who did we, I mean, we probably should move on, but did was it Andy Mackay and Paul Hodgkinson who took over?
I think
Chris and Mark.
I don't think Paul was there. They got Paul in slightly later. I think Andy took over. I'm trying to think whether he would have been with anyone else at that point. Yeah, and it was really difficult to get a handle on because obviously Andy was one of the gang and was head of art and, you know, was a very big part of it. And it was difficult to know, and I still don't really know what happened, but it felt... Obviously, they'd ousted Chris and Mark, which was terrible and put you off the place anyway. But then when you don't really know what's happened and who's done what and there's all different rumours going around, it's kind of very unsettling. And also... inevitably, it's not going to be as good as it was.
Yeah.
However good the people coming in, it won't be as good as that.
So off to Liga Stellini, very different boss.
Very different boss, but the same system. In your room. You know, at that point, there would have been the Marshall brothers and the I'm trying to think who else, Rob and Dave. And it would be the same kind of, it seems so cosy, quaint in retrospect that... they would just stay in their office. Everybody would stay in their office, really, really trying hard to crack the brief. Yeah. There would be no, you know, I remember there was that quote that, is it Colin Millwood or someone said about CDP, said he can always tell who's working hard in his department. It's because when he walks through the corridors, the ones who are working hard are staring blankly out the window, you know. And it's kind of like that, you know, you'd be in your room, you know, just leaving for there was no... sitting in there writing.
And we used to hear very funny stories that because the Marshall brothers came to Lowe's, because Steve Dunn had been at Liga for so long, when he came to Lowe's, they came over. So there were all sorts of stories about, you know, that secretaries would be dispatched to get lunch.
Yeah.
Go and get a sandwich so that you didn't waste 30 minutes away from the pad writing.
Well, our first week, so when we started with Tony, so... we got a Porsche brief with a week on it, a Porsche campaign. And me and Tony got in at either 7:30 or 8 every morning, and we left at 8. And then that day was sitting as we are now, really concentrating. What about this? There was no break. It's like a really intense day for whatever that is, 12 hours. And we built up stuff, and we got to the end of the week. We had our sort of... took in about 10 ads, having weeded out stuff, worked really, really hard. It's amazing how much you can do if you don't do anything else for 12 hours on the trot. And Tim sort of went through. I wonder which ones he likes, he hasn't said yet. And he went, okay, I'm not sure we've got anything there. What time's the meeting? And we said, oh, it's like 2. He went, okay. Leave it with me. We were like horrified. For me, it's my first week. For Tony, he's been there. I don't know. And then we saw him calling the Marshall brothers. Blah, blah, blah. We can see through the window. He's chatting away. They went out. 2 hours later, they went in. And the difference was this time he created 2 piles.
Yeah.
Rather than 1 pile with us. And then one of the piles he gave them back. And then they went and macked them up. So that was 2 hours.
Yeah.
So it's partly... in retrospect, because they know what he'll buy. They're in the groove of doing the stuff that he wants as a whole. And partly, probably, he might think, welcome to Liga Stellini.
Yeah, I mean...
I'm not going to buy a thing. I can't believe there was one that you like... He must have just thought...
But I can well believe... There was still... You know, he used to keep the briefs back and give them to you on a Friday so that, you know, or give them to you with 48 hours to go and stuff like that. I think there was a lot of...
It was always... Yeah, I mean, it was unusual to get a week. We got a week, probably on the upside, we got a week. Because, I mean, I half don't think he's that conniving that he'd think I'd give him relatively a lot of time, but then I'll reject everything. But you rarely would get a week.
But it was amazing. I mean, it produced so much work. We used to stare at it. And I think I said when we were talking last time that they would always beat you in the awards because the Marshall brothers, we'd enter, you know, an Olympus ad and 2 Reebok ads, and the Marshall brothers would tip a sort of wheelbarrow full of all of this stuff, and it was good stuff.
Yeah.
And it looked like a great place to go. Not if you wanted to see your wife or your kids or go out, you know, to the pub and have free weekends, but if you wanted to make work.
Yeah. Well, it was very similar to Simon's Palmer in you create all your stuff, you hand it over. There's no real conversation about what do you think. It's like, and sometimes literally stuff would be ticked, like a,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
tick, tick, tick. I mean, the massive upside for me, well, there's two upsides. A, the speed then. It's funny because then we would have been, some briefs would be, you know, like 2 hours. Like the marshal, eventually you get into that thing where you've got 2 hours, which then was really, really unusual. Now it's, I don't know, it's not quite as, not so unusual. Then it was really weird. Nobody did work in campaigns in 2 hours or 4 hours. The upside is for me, it didn't really stress me out because I thought, it's ridiculous. 2 hours, I'll do what I can. You know, it was almost like the opposite of stress. Whereas I used to go to Alistair at Lowe's and...
yeah, he'd have a month.
And he'd have a month. He'd be going up the walls.
Yeah.
He's going to the cinema. He's not sure whether to write or go to the cinema or what to do.
But one of the... I enjoyed Lowe's so much because it was a little Liga Stellini. We had a little Liga Stellini in the middle of it. And I loved that. We just... And I liked the sometimes a week, but sometimes 2 hours and someone hasn't cracked it and all that. You know, you'd always be...
A blend of big...
Yeah. And you were like, I don't know, sort of... The RNLI, always ready to get, you know, at any moment you look, and it was exciting. You think, well,
it's a bit like going in the army. Yeah, exactly. So it would not really stress me out that much because it wasn't like if you go in after 2 hours and you didn't buy anything, you think, well, I must be rubbish. You think, I've had 2 hours, I'll do what I can. So it was kind of freeing in a way.
And also, unusual things come out of that unusual time frame.
And also, most of the time, as you say, it's not that complicated. Do an ad for this, they want to say that.
Yeah.
But it's not like. Brain surgery.
What, and were you, so was there a more senior art director?
Yeah.
Because Tim obviously had Steve Dunn for a long time there, and Steve would be in charge of the look of everything and work with Tim. When you went there, was there an equivalent who was...
So when I first went there, Martin Galton was there working with Tim, who was really nice, probably the total opposite of Steve, I would imagine. Martin's very... he'll just try stuff. He's not too stressed about... He'll say, fuck it, try that, try this. He's quite relaxed.
Yeah.
So he was there, but he wasn't as on everything as probably Steve would have been and I would be, you know, which has its benefits, you know.
Did you migrate up... running the art directional side of the agency quite quickly.
So then so probably within 18 months, I was made head of art.
Yeah.
So I think Martin left. And then about 18 months later, I think I just started to get some stuff out on Adidas. And I'd done Adidas running stuff and some other stuff. And I mean, in retrospect, I was probably very young. But I was made head of art, yeah.
So the probably my favourite ad of all time of yours, actually, is the Just to the Lamppost, which I believe was your first pencil. Is that right?
Yeah.
96?
Yeah.
I actually kind of... It's funny. I like the stuff that that wasn't particularly Liga Stellini.
Do you like what?
Well, I like things like, you know, A, Find Your Own B and the Lamppost. It wasn't that classic. That did-dum-de-dum-de-dum, and then you make it look nice. I tell you a campaign that I loved. No, I'm sure no one will know what I'm talking about, but that Hyundai corporate campaign with the little illustrations where it was all, you know, he had trouble parking. I remember...
It's funny
I had a
that.
Photocopy of that, some, you know, when we all used to keep... you're a hoarder. I'm a sort of short-term hoarder, and then I throw everything away, and then 2 years later I go, shit, where were those illustrations? That was a Japanese illustrator?
Yeah, Satoshi KB, actually.
So I remember those really clearly, and actually I remember the Prince Nassim, the Here on Business TV. No, did the Douglas Brothers?
Yeah, they did, yeah.
I went to a... where did I go? I went to the National Portrait Gallery recently, and I was standing in the corridor. There was a load of Douglas Brothers photographs with the thing that they'd had a row when they fell out and stopped working together, and basically all of this stuff had been put in a warehouse, and then the warehouse was going to be demolished, and someone found it all, and
there was an exhibition
someone connected to the National Portrait got it all out
and they dusted it all down and went, wow, this is all like, you know, Helen Mirren and whatever incredible photographs.
They were great.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that was a real, the agency, anyway.
I think the interesting thing with them, again, it's funny because you, like a sort of magpie, you pick up all these things as you go. So the way of working, and I don't know whether it'd come from Steve or Tim or whatever, would be they'd say, we need some running ads. Let's get the Douglas brothers to go with some runners to Mexico.
Yeah.
Shoot the shit out of that for 2 weeks and send them back in. So it wouldn't be the classic Colletts or, imagine, Lowe's pre-Steve Dunn where you draw the thing and you think, we want someone like that. His arms at 45 degrees, his knees
there. Now.
You go shoot some runners, pick someone cool, shoot some runners, and we'll pick which ones we choose. So the benefit of that is that when I did the just the lamppost ad, I sort of, it's funny because all the ads you've picked are ones that Tim wasn't keen on initially. So, and that was sort of rejected. It was a terrible little scruffy rough that I'd done, but it was, I thought, well, I do that. That was one of a pile of, I thought, well, I do that when I'm running. And it was rejected. But the benefit was, having talked to a few people, I said, do you do this thing? And Tony Davidson go, yeah, I do that. I think it's good. So I then went down and we would have drawers and drawers full of Douglas Brothers shots. So I'd just go through thinking, is there a street in there?
You can,
that I can mock it up. So I found one with a street in, retouched the runner out, mocked it up and then represented it, all fired up to have a big argument with Tim. And it went through. But so that was a shot that was just kicking around in the basement from one of their shoots, which was handy, you know.
That's but a great way of working, though.
Yeah.
I think that the freedom to just let them go and see what comes back, and you know you're going to get some sort of expected
stuff. You get much better results.
All sorts of interesting.
Yeah. And they were particularly good. I mean, they were great.
But I mean, I have made just little notes. I thought, the stuff I like is the sort of non-legus. So the English Heritage and Harrods, which is very, very fine work, but it's
very legus.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And I think the things where you, I get, it's the same old thing, isn't it? You always look at it and you think, fuck, I wish I'd done that, and B, I wonder if I could have. And for the English Heritage, I think, I could have written headlines in that area. And then I'm sure if I'd had Steve Dunn or Dave Dyer, then they would have put it together and we could have. Whereas the other things you look at and you think, they're great, and they're not just legus. They're really, that's someone putting an, you know, you're making your mark there.
Well, I think you probably go through your stage as you get older of trying to do your own thing. I think you start off trying to copy people who you think are good. So initially, Tim was very fixed in what he likes, which is, and I'd think, well, it's his agency. You know, if I don't like it, I should go. You can't, there's no good going somewhere and then trying to get him to, you know, like different stuff. But then as you go on, you have a bit more confidence and a bit stronger view of what you like. And I think, the Hyundai stuff, for example, I remember he absolutely hated and wanted to pull. The client really liked them. They were bought, they were made, we'd done the illustrations, and he was looking into, I mean, on the outside, I suppose you've got to say, it's good that he really cares, because who can be asked? You know, everybody's happy, except for him. And he was trying to pull out the media and just absolutely hated them. Can't remember what the point is. So somehow I can't remember how that would have got that far with perhaps he was on holiday or something. I can't remember. But
the good thing about Adidas, it looked like from the outside at the time, was that it was such a fast growing thing.
Yeah.
It was fashion and exercise. There was so much work needed that there was inevitably there were going to be, it was going to open up a bit. There was no way that Tim could absolutely passionately sit on top of everything. Sooner or later you would write some headlines, but sooner or later you were going to do some stuff that didn't really fit into that box because they just needed so much work.
Yeah, that's true. And I think he was, don't get me wrong, he was very much behind, he had an idea of what Adidas should be, which was, he didn't, for example, at that time, Adidas, it's funny because the things change, it's hard to imagine what it was like then, but Adidas was sort of up and it was like a brand from the 70s that had got turned a bit bad, a bit like Pierre Cardin or something. It got a bit crap and was trying to get back up, and there were certain people like the Manchester bands were wearing them, and they were sort of, it was sort of slightly undercover, that it was seen as cool in some areas, So I remember the creative department, we were saying, look, because Oasis would come in to the agency and there'd be this massive office full of shoes, and they'd have to say, look, pick whatever ones you want. So these guys from this band Oasis would come in, root through the shoes, take them away. And we'd the creators would say, look, why can't we, let's get them to do an ad, or let's get, you know, this other band. And he would be, no, it's got to be all about the sport, and it's got to be the, what we've got to do is we've got to show that we understand the person doing the sport. I don't want to get into the glitz and the glamour, that's Nike. Yeah. So he had a really clear view on what he wanted, and within that, you know, we ended up, there's some of the stuff we could put our own stamp on it, but he was like totally, it seemed to make, didn't make much sense to us at the time, because having come from Nike, the chance of doing some stuff with Oasis, who were like really hot and cool at the time, and some of the other people who were wearing it would have sounded interesting, or you can imagine the sort of posters you do if you're Nike on that sort of stuff. Although I don't know whether they've ever done bands, but yeah, so you know, as you go on, and the volume of it, I think, is really was really, really useful to me, because it, you have to change from being super controlling and anal and worried about overthinking stuff to thinking, let's give that a try.
Yeah.
Okay, let's give it a go. Who knows? You know. Yeah. And when there's a volume, you don't. Well, you can take chances and make mistakes. They don't all have to be.
Yeah, because you're coming back amazing. Tomorrow morning to make another one. So
exactly. So that was great.
I think that is really, really, really healthy. You know, that.
I mean, it's one of the positives of now. You know, that you get less time now, but depending on how you work, you can produce a shitload of stuff now.
Yeah, and. You want to be that. You want to be that team or that person. You want to be making and busy and trying stuff and active. And so, how long did you stay at Legas then?
I was at Legas, I think, 5 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
Okay. I my chronology is out.
I think it was 5 years.
So then, the next destination is Bishopsbridge Road, so
yeah.
BNP DDB.
Yeah,
so
that scruffy little building over in Bishopsbridge Road.
how did that come about? I mean, did you? Because I think you, there's no doubt, Legas is your sort of ramp up to hyperspace.
Yeah, no, totally.
I mean,
yeah.
That is suddenly like, this bloke is everywhere. The work is great. I even like the GQ socks.
Do you?
Yeah, well, because I just think, imagine going to Legas Delaney and getting that out.
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably
a sort
not
of GGT.
It's funny, yeah,
a GGT poster.
It is, yeah. It's, you know, a total GGT. And the other one that went with it is even more of a GGT. The
kid with the hair.
Sticking his hair up.
Yeah. So you think, you know, was Tim, you know, was Tim
well,
away
think,
for 2 weeks?
I think you could do a little timeline of when, of partly confidence growing, but when you start, you're giving fuel to someone to shape that they want. And then as you go, you know, I remember with certain ads, the sort of lamppost one being one of them, you think, come on, let me pick an ad. You know, I'm head of art. I've done a lot of stuff on this now. You don't have to pick every last little ad. So some of these things would sort of find their way out. you know, he'd give us a bit of leeway on some things. And then there was a period when Tim was away that I was asked to sort of look after it for someone in his family was ill. So then all of a sudden there was like this, you're handing your homework in and it being marked, and sometimes you think, not another, but dare we say, you sir, or the, you know, whatever the thing says. And you sort of then, because you're used to doing things, you try and break out of it, but you're used to doing things a certain way, the chance of doing whatever you want is just amazing. So we had a little period where we did a different kind of work. We just did, you know, what we liked. And that was great. So that, and Tony Cox had phoned me from BNP and said, you know, we talked about going over there and I wasn't. Then I'd had this period of sort of having a bit of, you know, this idea of picking your own ads or picking other people's ads, thinking, gosh, this is great, you know. And then he phoned again and I said, we should go there, we've done this now, let's pick our own stuff, you know.
And was this an offer to go with Tony?
This was Tony Cox phoned us, and
sorry,
this
no,
was an office to offer
Tony
to go with Sean.
Sean,
yeah, so, sorry, so I'd worked with Sean through most of Legas Delaney.
Yeah, because the Adidas,
the lamppost one I did on my own,
and
the
A to B
campaign
was
Sean.
So when had Tony had got, didn't Tony get went to Lowe's, didn't he, or did he go M&C or something?
Tony was at Liga Stellini. Yeah, I forgot to. So I worked with Tony and then Dave Hyatt for about 6 months, and then Will Audrey for a year, and then Sean for whatever's left, like 2 years maybe.
Yeah.
And we worked really well together. So, yeah, and I think it's funny. I used to play football with all the people at BNP. Me and Tony Davison would go from Leagues to play football under the Westway with all the BNP creative department on Monday night. So yeah. I got to know them through that. And there would be Richard Clinton, who'd recently got there, and say, oh, it's really good, you know, you should come over, when Tony said you should come. So we thought, yeah, you know, it'd be different. So we kind of did that.
And that was a great department, wasn't it?
Well, it's interesting because...
Tony Cox had a...
So the our leaving card says everything, really, as to where BNP was at that time, because our leaving card said goodbye and you open it up and it said two awards.
But also that says everything about Leagues to
play. Yeah, I don't know who'd done that. But the reason was, the reason people like Tony and Kim had left BNP, as it was that everything got bogged down. This was their view. Everything got bogged down and nothing would happen. Sometimes you get one ad out a year. And then that would have to go through 7 rounds of research. And that's kind of how it was seen. And it was, you know, it had times when it was amazing. But this time, the view wasn't that it was amazing. But what people didn't know is that it had changed a lot. And there was a lot of people in there. And Richard and Andy were a big part of...
I was going to say, Rich and Andy were smashing it.
They'd only just... This is pre-internet. So let's say they've got there 6 months before. There's no awards have come out. There's no internet.
Yeah.
You might have seen the odd commercial come up, but they're early ones. So when we got there, it was great. I mean, the creative department was like Richard and Andy, Nick Gill. Jeremy. There was like tons of really good people. And I think what Richard and Andy had, somehow, they'd kind of stirred it up by... I don't know, they had a different attitude or were more determined or whatever, but they'd sort of started to change things.
Yeah.
And I think also they had this thing that they would work on anything. So rather than going in just working on Volkswagen, they'd work on Marmite, which wasn't a great thing at one point, or they'd work on anything, really.
Yeah, so just get stuck.
And they started to flip those things. So those things that were previously considered not worth working on all of a sudden were... starting to be good, and that's quite contagious. So then other people would think, well, hang on, why don't we work on whatever it may be? And that started to spread. So
also the people with the briefs start seeking out Richard and Andy or some of teams like that, because they're like...
So they start giving them more and more opportunities.
They're hungry. This will work.
So were you
head of art? You went across, and were you going to have some accounts and look after those as well?
Well, I think they had a system there which was...
Docs. Was it? Directors of Creativity?
Yeah. I don't know why they switched the words system. Around. Yeah. But but what it was is nobody particularly had accounts. There were docs, and there was about six of us or something, I can't remember. And briefs would come in, and then they'd be assigned. So you didn't really have an account, but, you know, maybe this campaign is them, and you'd keep switching it.
Yeah.
And it would mean...
Can we have a break?
Yeah. Sorry.
You're definitely going to have to edit this, though.
Yeah.
That's the agreement, isn't
it? Yeah. Do you edit it? Do what you want?
No.
Tell me what needs to come out. I can't edit me.
I'm going to let you decide what the world is.
They're not much use on air.
Thank you. Brilliant.
Let's grab some of those quickly.
Yeah, I'm thinking I'm probably going a bit slow, actually. We've only got to B&B. Also, what I would say, if anything you think of, even if you think, oh, is that bad? Say it. Because we can edit it if it's too bad.
Yeah.
But don't think. Literally say anything you want, okay, and I'll answer. Do you know what I mean? If it occurs to you.
There's so much to cover.
Yeah, I know. I should. Anyway.
No, you shouldn't do anything. I don't think it's sort of. It's not sagging at all. I just think we've got to.
Yeah.
We've got to go through it all and then work out in the edit what we can live without.
But as I say, if you go, you idiot, why did you just say? I'm not. Right, you ready, Harry?
Yeah, we're ready. So
ready? I don't see any red lights, but is it on? Okay, sorry. Right, go on. Where did we get to?
We were so B&P. Richard and Andy were stirring it up, and you thought, right, we'll go across. Oh yeah, and so you didn't have accounts, but you
The
dock system.
So that is a sort of system that at the time there was sort of questions about would that work well, because 1 minute you were creative directing Nick Gill, the next minute he's creating directing you or Richard and Andy or whoever. Yeah. So it's a sort of
I don't mind that. I think that's a good idea. I think it's a bit odd unless you're looking after an account the whole time, because you need to know it and feel your way through it, and you need to have. But
I think it would be in chunks, you know. So there may be the obsession campaign for Volkswagen would be there, and then the Polo campaign might be, you know, be divided up into chunks. I guess it might be one of those things you go, well, given that they did the Marmite thing last year, they might as well get the new, you know.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be completely like random, but nobody in theory, I don't think, had an account.
But it was a good time to join there, I think, wasn't it? Because you had the best of the old, like, the sort of all the greatness baked into B&P DDB, and then you had Rich and Andy and you guys and people like that arriving. And
yeah, it was amazing. If you go back to that card where it says goodbye to awards, ironically, the next year they were top of the Gum Report.
Yeah.
You know, so there was like loads of stuff happening that people didn't really know that really came through. So it was, you know, it was really good. There was a really good vibe. Most of the teams were really good. There was a sort of a thing that I think Richard and Andy had started of how could we flip the next thing. So there's always the really good accounts like Volkswagen, but it would be how can we flip something else, you know. Yeah. So we got a thing on I think I'd seen an adapt, because you had about, you see all this stuff going through, there's an adapt for an American Airlines poster that had been sent over from Dallas or somewhere to run over here. So I said, well, can't we pitch in an idea? Why don't we just have to run that? That's garbage.
Yeah.
So we had a go at something and they bought it, bizarrely, like against all the odds, because we just used to import the work. And then that led to us doing more stuff on it that did well. You know, we did
different angles
and that ended up being quite a good account. So there were sort of certain teams that would think, well, let's have a go at trying to make that better, which is a great vibe when you've got a ton of business to just keep trying to flip things.
You're in a good class at school, aren't you?
And yeah.
Everyone's pulled up, but also presumably with a bit more freedom than the Ligus Delaney.
Totally, yeah.
And so everyone is able to. I mean, Rich and Andy did some things that people thought, yeah, B&P, DDB, don't do that.
Well,
I'm going to go through. So I bet you no one ever says, I tell you what I loved. I love that, the Budweiser Heritage.
Yeah,
stuff
I really
that you
liked
did with
that.
The three, you know, Al Capone, whatever, and the date, and then, Budweiser. And I don't know if that, American Airlines, definitely. I thought that was great. Protection, the dotty illustration, I thought was
well. Lovely. I think the Budweiser stuff I really, really liked. It was after we'd done the people getting a bit cocky, but after we'd got the Gum Report Agency of the Year or top of the Gum Report, when the awards came around again, there was like a betting thing. Everybody would put a tenner in on what's going to win the most awards and what's ridiculous, really. Sounds bad now. But and of the whole department, that came out top. that they thought would win the most, that would win the most at DNA Day and whatever. Didn't get in DNA Day, that campaign. So you can't, but I particularly really like that because it's a difficult brief of say that we've been around a long time.
Well, it's just, it's the oldest brief, you know, it just rolls off the photocopier. We've been around for a long time.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's done, I like it because it's done with wit and brevity, which I think is a hallmark of yours as well, is that you're good at sort of boiling it down. But it's also because it's unfancied, you know, it's not a Volkswagen, it's not a...
Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing, but, you know, American Airlines and Budweiser and things like that, you think, oh, crap, that's interesting. I didn't know they had that. And now they're doing some good stuff on it. And it's a proper client brief. You know, I mean, you can have any client says, can you tell everyone we've been around for ages?
Well, it's funny. At the time, BNP didn't want to. The debate was Budweiser want to do a kind of heritage campaign, but we've said heritage campaigns are old fashioned by their nature and you shouldn't do it. And we said, well, let's have a go at trying to do, you know, the information isn't old-fashioned. It's just how you do it. It doesn't have to be screwed to copy with pictures of barley and wheat woven through it.
Yeah.
Let's just try and... Because it was to go in ID in the face and all those kind of things. So we ended up... we ended up doing that.
And was Tony there the whole time you were there?
He was there.
Did he run the department or...?
Most of the time. So he was great because he was, like, really good at picking teams and he would just... trust all of the teams. So sometimes there'd be a debate, you know, he had this doc system, directors of creativity. Sometimes there would be a disagreement between the docs and the account management and they would go into Tony to complain or to disagree or to ask for another team. And he'd say, it's not really, he'd be reading the Guardian, so it's not really my, it's up to them really, to be honest. And carry on reading, which is what you
That's
want.
That's the job you want.
Absolutely.
That is the job
so
I want.
So on the face of it, it looks like he was doing very little. He's
but
reading
he
The Guardian.
Hired.
But he hired well, and he trusted them, and he backed them. And actually, you know, he's one of those classic people that it all looks so easy.
Yeah.
But I think they noticed when he went, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot that he was doing that they didn't see. You know, he would always be popping in with... And I think in retrospect now, it would just be... to have a chat and to feel like you're being supported. On that brief that you're doing, is there anything in Jack Nicholson? Is there anything in... It'd be the most random stuff that would be, on the one hand, no particular help, but it feels like he cares and that he's involved and he's pitching in a few things, trying to help. It's very useful, you know.
He gets consistently very, very positive feedback from anyone who was there at the time, in that he wasn't a Tim Delaney, he wasn't all over everything.
Oh,
he's of the copy.
Yeah, he's the opposite.
But he got great people in, gave them good briefs and let them get on with it. And you know, I think it was you look back at that department and the work that was coming out of there and it worked.
Yeah. So I think he was there for about 18 months and I think the agencies always kind of swing from one end of the spectrum to the other. So at the time, that system, I think BNP at the time was the second biggest agency in the country. So it had a lot of business, but the doc system produced lots of good work, but it must have been difficult for the account people and probably the planners because you couldn't, you had to go with what they were saying. And because we all knew each other, they couldn't put the brief in anywhere else. And we were all talking to each other. It was probably a pain in the arse, you know. Yeah. Probably people were a bit overly precious and stubborn, and there'd be some downsides.
Were you winning business as well? Because it sounds like it was a system that's great for what you've got in the building and looking after it, but going out and kind of...
I don't remember lots of wins, but as I say, they were second. I think they were second biggest in the country, so there would be a lot of conflicts, and I don't know how much that we would have pitched, but. You know, a lot of big accounts. But so then what they did is everybody was loving it. So we would go to play football on Monday night and there was a real, people are enjoying it. We're winning awards. It's sort of competitive, but in a good way. It was really, really good. And then all of a sudden they said, I remember Richard told me, he said, we've got a new boss. So I said, oh, you're joking, really? Who? And he went, Barker. I went, Barker? Who, Barker? What do you mean? Who's Barker? I just couldn't connect. It wasn't nothing against Larry, but it wasn't like famous. It's not like saying Delaney or...
Yeah.
I was thinking, who's Barker? And he went, oh, Larry Barker. I said, Larry, why? Why are they... What, why? What's the... You know, it seems like it's working well. So I can only imagine that they thought, we need to change. You know, we need to be more... Can't be... we're only presenting that ad, and if they don't buy it, we've got to present it again, and it's got to loosen up, and we've got to, you know, perhaps have less tension with it. I don't know what was behind it, less tension with the clients, or I don't know what the thing was.
Also,
but
well, at the time, WCRS was doing...
Larry had done a lot of good work.
Orange,
you know, it wasn't,
and stuff like that, which was sort of, it had a different type of creativity behind it, but it was big and real people
you
know, noticed it, and BMW. They made... There was a lot of sort of... what did we used to call it? You know, there was a lot of... Felt like smoke and mirror. It was a lot of pizzazz. There wasn't the classic idea
wasn't the
underneath it that BMP did.
Volkswagen-y, BMP, smaller human things. And it may have been that. I know that apparently John Webster was very behind Larry. And I don't say anything bad about Larry getting it. It just didn't feel like he was needed. It wasn't saying why him. It was like,
and there was
why would they put someone else in? It seems so strange.
But there was then, again, certainly it felt like from the outside, quite a... aggressive and deliberate undermining. I mean, I don't know whether it doesn't sound like Larry did himself favors
no.
in certain ways, but there was also a concerted, systematic undermining of him. And I think he dropped the ball slightly on that big Vodafone ad, and I think had talked it up a bit. And but
I think I mean, I think it's difficult when you come in to establish yourself, and I think it went from being a very convivial, matey system that was top of the gun report to put your name in the diary. We're showing three routes. We're going to review the work with the client, with the account people in the room. There was like a lot of new, you know, it's got that 100-day Napoleon thing where you got to make your mark. And I don't know whether it was as calculating as that, but there was like all of a sudden there was a lot of new rules that you think, is this going to make the work better? What's the sort of thinking behind all this? So, so all of a sudden, you felt from having complete control over whatever it is to you're one of three teams going in, showing work to Larry and the account team, and then, or more, and then they would present three routes on to the client. I might be generalising this. I mean, that was sort of my memory of that experience. And obviously that was difficult for people to adapt to because it felt like everyone's doing good work. Don't know why we're doing that or how that's going to help. So I think about 6 months into that, there was a real backlash against that. Yeah. So there were people behaving badly and coming up with nicknames and trying to undermine him.
Yeah.
And I thought, I don't want to be part of that. If I don't like it, I should go.
Yeah.
I don't want to be, you know, there are certain people that we probably know that operate in that thing, which I didn't like. So by this time, Tony had gone to Abbott Mead and we talked to, it's funny, I mentioned this to someone the other night. We talked to M&C Saatchi, had quite an in-depth lot of chats with them. Because the feeling was they've come out of Saatchi's, but they haven't quite got it together creatively.
Yep.
You know, it was like a good to be one of the creative directors with James and Simon.
Yep.
So that sounded really good with me and Sean. And then there was also Abbott Mead come up, and I remember getting bogged down in this thing's shares, there's this thing against that thing, that agency's probably... And I remember going out to lunch with Derek Haas, saying...
Who
I knew from Publicis, I didn't mention, but he was really, really encouraging and helpful then. But, yeah, he was a really good friend. And I don't know whether you knew Derek, but he's not the sort of... On one level, he's not the sort of person you would give an issue to sort of break down and weigh up. He's a very instinctive person. So I went through... I said, oh, between us, there's these things. I'm just thinking about what to do.
Yeah.
And I went through the whole issue. It took me ages to sort of go, on the good, on this side, there's that. They've got shares. That might be harder there, but then this thing. Spent ages and ages going through, like it's some big tortured process. He went, well, I know what I'd do. I said, what? He said, I'd go to Abbott Mead. So I said, oh, okay, what's your thinking? He went, it's better.
Thank you.
Yeah. And you think, yeah, that's the key bit I've missed out. That's just better. So we went to Abbot Mead.